everybody. My name's Hunter Dean. I'm a recovered alcoholic.
Hey, Hunter.
A lot of people, this is awesome. Tonight's speaker is Whitney. I met Whitney nearly about 2 years ago. We're the same home group, and we just became friends, you know, just learned how to become friends with one another, and through a course of events, you know, started dating and fell in love, and now we're engaged, so this is Whitney.
I really wish I had a podium I could hide behind. I'm Whitney, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Whitney!
My sponsor said that after the first 5 minutes, God comes in, so disregard anything I say in the first 5 minutes. my sobriety date, just in case you were wondering, is August 10th, 2009. So that means that, God willing, 5 days from now, I will have 2 years. And
yeah.
That's a miracle. It really is. I guess I'll just start from the beginning with you guys. I was born July 20th, 1987 in a small town in Albany, Georgia. Southwest Georgia, pretty country, kind of backwards. Most people say they've been through it on their way to the beach. That's where I'm from. I was born into a family, mother and father, and a brother who is 4 years older than me. He's my half-brother. We have different dads. But to me, he was my brother. We grew up together, same household, you know. Only difference was every other weekend, he would go and visit his dad. And that was about it, you know. My childhood... I have that normal part of my childhood, you know, kind of like most kids have, where I rode my bicycle and climbed trees and fell down and skinned my knees and, you know, went to school, kind of normal kid stuff. I was always the only girl in the neighborhood, and my older brother didn't like me tagging along and playing with the guys, but that's what I had to do because I didn't have anybody else. So I kind of... you know, grew up surrounded by guys, and for a long time, and probably still today, I'm kind of more comfortable with guys than I am chicks, and and also that more will be revealed in my story about that. I come from a family of alcoholics and drug addicts. My mom and my dad are both, and they will admit that, I'm sure. So there was a lot of chaos in my household growing up. Like I said, I had that, you know, riding my bike, climbing trees kind of childhood. But then there was, you know, the night times where things weren't so fun. Me and my brother grew up in bars. And I guess one of the upsides of growing up in bars is you learn some really cool rock and roll music. So I've got that going for me. every night, you know, and it might not have been every single night we went to the bar, but, you know, every night we'd be at the bar, and it was fun. I mean, you know, there were other kids there. Their parents were drinking, too. And so my brother and I and all the other kids would run around and play and have a good old time. And I can remember running inside the bar and saying, "I'm thirsty." And mom or dad saying, "Well, here, have a sip of this." And one time I thought it was beer, you know, and I thought it was tasted horrible. I remember one time when I was little asking my mom, "Why do you drink that stuff? It is so bad." And she said, "It's an acquired taste." And I thought, why would you drink anything that you have to acquire a taste for? I don't understand that. I mean, now, of course, I understand that. You know, I'm not going to go into graphic detail, but there was a lot of violence in my household. I saw a lot of things that I probably shouldn't have seen. And for me, the feelings that I felt during those times, I was terrified. I know the true meaning of terror And that's how I spent a lot of my childhood, was in terror. And so as a method to survive, I had to shut down completely. I had to not feel. And they say, you know, that's a lot, what a lot of people go through when they go to war, you know, and they're in the military. You have to shut down. You have to shut your emotions down, because if you feel the feelings that you want to feel at that time, you won't survive. So I had to shut down a lot. You know, and I remember my dad sitting me on his lap one day after a horrific night in our household, him sitting me down on his lap and saying, now you know, Whitney, I love you. And you know that you did nothing wrong, and that this has nothing to do with you. And I said, okay. But that caused a little confusion in my mind, because I'm thinking, if I could just get them to focus on me and not on that alcohol that they're drinking, then, or if I could get them to focus on me and not on each other, then they wouldn't fight, you know? So if I could just maybe, like, sing pretty enough or dance, you know, or be loud enough, the attention would be on me and not on each other, and the craziness wouldn't happen. So I guess at that young age, I started carrying that weight on my shoulders and thinking that I had the power to change people and to affect what other people did. And I know today that that's not the case. My parents, like good alcoholics do, they divorced, remarried, divorced, got back together. Maybe some people in this room can relate to that. Honestly, when I was 7 years old and they sat me down, they said they were getting a divorce, my brother cried, and I was ecstatic. Because that meant that the craziness was over. Like I said, you know, a lot of things happened within that time. When I was 9 years old, let me backtrack a little bit. This is a big part of my story. I'm also not going to go into graphic detail. Along with the craziness in my household, I had a next door neighbor who sexually abused me. Several times. And he said to me, don't tell anybody, because if you do, then I'll get in trouble and you'll get in trouble. So at 4 or 5 years old, I took that to mean that I had done something wrong, and that if anybody found out, there would be consequences. So I buried it deep down inside and I didn't tell anybody. When I was 9 years old, both of my parents decided they were going to go to treatment. And so they go off to treatment, and they come back, and shortly thereafter, and this is the way I saw it. This might not have been the way it really happened, but my mom took off and moved 3 hours away and got remarried. And to me, it happened in a day's time. One day she was there, the next day she was gone. One day we had a family of four, the next day we had a family of two. It was me and my dad. My brother moved in with his dad, my mom moved 3 hours away. There was a lot of silence in a house that used to be loud. There was a lot of sadness in a house where a lot of times we had fun. There were a lot of emotions that went unspoken because of the silent pain that my dad and I were living through at that time. So I had a lot of anger and rage at my dad for some of the things that he put us through. But when my mom left, all that anger went from my dad to my mom. All right, she abandoned me. I carried that resentment around. Fast forward to the eighth grade, and I come out with my secret. It wasn't my choice to come out with it. I told a friend who told a friend, and it came out in school, and it came out in a really bad way, and it came out in front of everybody. And my secret was out about my abuse that I had as a child. And at that time, I started counseling. You know, a lot of people, when they tell their stories, they talk about the first time that they drank. And they talk about it being this, like, spiritual experience and, you know, and they just remember the feeling that they had when they, you know, got wasted the first time. And a few weeks ago, I was thinking back on it, and I'm like, man, like, why can't I, you know, I'm trying to think of the first time that I drank and what it was like and how I felt. And it hit me, and I'm telling you, this happened literally like 2-3 weeks ago. It hit me. The first time that I really got wasted, we were down in Panama City for spring break, and I was in the 8th grade, and my mom had taken us down there. And boy, we had a good old time. And I didn't have to drink that nasty beer that my parents were drinking. I started out on, like, some good tasting stuff, you know, some wine coolers and stuff like that. But I was thinking back on it, and I thought, you know what? Probably why I don't remember that being, like, a significant thing for me, that first time I really got drunk, was also on that same trip, was when I came out to my mom and my stepdad and my brother, and I sat them down and I said, this is what happened to me when I was a little kid. I guess that kind of scarred my drinking experience. Nonetheless, I pushed on through, and I continued drinking and doing some other outside issues from that time on, about 12 or so, 11 or 12 onward. My dad got sober, and after my mom left, and we started going to church. And it was my first time ever really being in a church, you know, and it was like a small church, and they were really like family there. And I remember the first time I went, I was like, Dad, I'm staying with you. Like, I am not going into another room. They ain't taking me nowhere. I'm staying with you. And they were like, come on, you know, we've got a children's group over here. And so I went, and I loved it. Like, for the first time in my life, that God-sized hole inside of me was filled. And I, you know, and I found God, and I believed everything they taught me in that church. And I, man, I soaked it up like a sponge. And I was truly happy for a while, you know. That was about the age of 9. And then, you know, puberty hit, and boys came on the scene. And alcohol and drugs, and God kind of just went out the window. And that sadness came back in, and that depression came back in, and that feeling alone came back, you know, just feeling like nobody, feeling like I was different, feeling like you can't understand what I've been through. And if you've been through what I've been through, you'd be doing exactly what I'm doing. So I use that as an excuse for a long time. You know, my dad started finding things around the house, and he didn't really appreciate it too much. And also, I remember the other day, my first time going to the hospital was in the 9th grade. I took a sip or, you know, a puff of something I shouldn't have, and I ended up in the hospital. And I remember my grandparents had to come and pick me up from the hospital. That was one of my first, like, incomprehensible, you know, demoralization kind of things, my grandparents having to come and pick me up from the hospital. And when my dad, you know, I sat down with my dad and I cried to him and I said, Dad, I'm never doing that again. Never. I've learned my lesson. I've been, you know, this was a traumatic experience. I'm not doing it again. And I meant it. With all of my heart, I meant it. And what do you know, not too long after that, I'm doing it again. Dad catches me again. And, you know, it's the same old song and dance. And every time I told him, I meant it with all my heart. Dad, I'm not going to do this stuff anymore. Finally, at the age of 16, he caught me once again. And he gave me an ultimatum. He said, Whitney, either you quit doing this stuff while you're living in my household or you gotta go. Well, I thought on it. And I thought, well, you know, every time that I've told him that I'm not going to do it, I really meant it. But I always end up doing it. And at that time, I had no knowledge of the obsession and the allergy and, you know, all that stuff that we learn in these rooms. And so what I did was I sat down and I wrote my dad a sweet little nice letter, because things always go better when you write him a letter. And I told him just what I told you. I said, every time I end up doing it again, and I know that, I just know I'm going to continue to do it. So I don't know what to tell you, but I'm going to keep doing it. That's all I know to tell you. In a sweet, you know, kind manner, I wrote it. And so my dad, being the tough dad that he was and is, to this day, with his tough love, he said, well, you got to go. Well, his plan kind of backfired on him, and my grandparents said I could come live with them, and because he thought that I would just freak out, that he was kicking me out, and that I'd change my mind, and, you know, everything would be good. So I moved in with my grandparents. Now, my grandparents, my Mimi and Peepaw, have been in my life. I know those are some good Southern names. They've been in my life, and they have been the most stable people in my life. They always lived in the same house. They, you know, never had financial problems. They weren't alcoholics or addicts or anything like that. You know, they were the straight and narrow, take care of you. You know, Mimi's gonna cook you dinner. And Peepaw's going to tell you to it like it is because he's a Marine. I moved in with them. And for the, you know, I had a stable life living there. I lived with them my whole senior year. And my Mimi would cook me breakfast every morning. She'd wake me up in the morning and she'd say, what do you want for breakfast? Pick it out. I got this, 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 and this. What do you want? I had oatmeal for the first time. I remember that. You know, I did really well while I was living with them, because what happened was it was my senior year of high school. Things were crazy. I got involved in theater really heavily. We were taking a trip to Scotland for theater, and we were raising money for that. And, you know, I'd go to school. I'd go to my job at the grocery store, and then I'd go back to school for play practice. My days were too full to, like, drink and do drugs, you know. My dad did not speak to me from the day he kicked me out. We didn't speak for a year. And for me, that was one of the hardest things, because me and my dad have a special bond, you know. It was just me and him for a long time. And for him not to speak to me, and he literally said, I'm washing my hands of you. And that wasn't enough for me to say, okay, I'll get sober. So I went a year without speaking to him, and, you know, I made it through high school, all was fine and dandy. Now, we did go on that Scotland trip, and I wasn't the best little girl on that trip. I did come out of that Scotland trip with 40 hours of community service. So I had to be at the high school every Saturday morning with the principal to do things around the high school. It was bad. And that just goes to show you, you know, something I worked so hard on. We raised money for a year, and we, you know, day in and day out, and somehow my alcoholism managed to get in there, and I couldn't control it. Once I started drinking over in Scotland, it was off to the races, and the other girls didn't show their asses the way I showed my ass, I guarantee you. They were not squatting on the side of the road, urinating. You know, that's when it started getting, you know, kind of out of control. And so I go off to college. I go to Macon, Georgia, to a school called Wesleyan College. It's an all-girls college. And lived in the dorms, and we weren't allowed to have alcohol in the dorms. But I didn't really listen to that. And my dorm was kind of the one that everybody came to, because that's where the alcohol was stored. And I got in a little trouble for that. So imagine all these consequences I start remembering after I get sober, because I was like, I don't have any consequences, you know? And yeah, I had to go in front of like the honor committee or whatever. So anyway, college, freshman year of college, the end of that, you know, I start drinking alone and I start getting into some other stuff. And one day I just wake up and I think, I'm addicted. Like, I can't live without alcohol and drugs, physically. And it was, I mean, it's hard for me to explain that to people, how one day I just woke up and realized that, because there was a, you know, a process leading up to that. But that's kind of how it happened. One day I woke up and I said, damn, this is a little out of control. I also got a DUI my freshman year of high school. What a disaster. Driving the wrong way down a one-way street in downtown Macon, Georgia, at 2 o'clock in the morning on a school night. And I decided to speak Spanish to the nice police officers that pulled me over. So therefore they thought that I could only speak Spanish, and they got the bilingual officer to come and speak to me. And he started asking me questions, and eventually I ran out of Spanish. I mean, and he said, where are you coming from? And I couldn't think of how to say that in Spanish, so I said, the bar right there. And he wasn't very happy with me, because he called me a liar, and I was like, dude, I never told you that I couldn't speak English. So they proceeded to, you know, they didn't do a sobriety test on that one. I don't, you know, they didn't need to. So they arrested me. And all that is funny, when I told that in front of an Al-Anon group, they didn't laugh. They didn't. I'm glad y'all are laughing, because I felt, I was like, I guess they're the ones that we call when we need to get bailed out of jail, so they didn't really find it too funny. Another one of those things, you know, it says in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it says, you know, pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And one of the things that happened on my little ride to the jailhouse was I really had to urinate. That happens when you drink a lot. And I asked them if I could go. And mind you, I was not being nice, okay, to these police officers. I wasn't. Now, I did try to play the victim for a long time after that and say it was all their fault that I got this DUI. But they told me they didn't have a bathroom and that I couldn't just go in the alley. So I had to urinate on myself in the back of that police car. And I had to walk through that precincts in my own urine. It wasn't embarrassing at the time, but when I look back at it now, it's sad, you know. They also said I was very, according to my mom, I was very combative with the police officers. And I just remember saying, why does it take two, you know, 250-pound guys to walk me down this hallway? Look at me. Like, am I really going to do anything? You know, and then they strip you naked, and they put you in an orange jumpsuit, and they give you a metal toilet, and they don't give you any toilet paper, and they give you a metal cot to sleep on. Luckily, I was in the room with the crackhead, so she didn't do any sleeping, so I got the cot to myself. And my mom came and bailed me out the next day. I went through so much for that. I think when I added up all the money it cost, for, you know, the probation fees, the lawyer, the everything, all added up, the license stuff, getting my license back, all that, I think it was about $6,000. A year of probation, DUI school, you name it. They threw the book at me. I felt at the time. And so, just to tell you the insanity of alcoholism, I went without my license for 16 or 17 months altogether, and I didn't drive. And I said, so help me God, when I get my license back, I am not drinking and driving. And I meant it. And not a week after I got my license back, I'm drinking and driving. It goes to show you. I wanted to read something in the doctor's opinion. It said men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They're restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks they see others taking with impunity, no consequences. After they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over, and unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of his recovery. Who in here has tried to quit more than once? More than 5 times? More than 10 times? My kind of people. I went to treatment for the first time at the age of 20, and I've thought all my life that somewhere, somehow, I just missed out on the handbook to life. I didn't get one, and all you other people got one. And so, when I woke up and I realized that I couldn't live life anymore without alcohol or drugs, I said, I need to go to one of these rehabs. And they're going to give me one of those handbooks that I missed out on. And I'm going to come back home after that, and everything's going to be fine. So I went. I was supposed to stay for 90 days. I talked them into 45. Because it was Thanksgiving, and I had to be home with my family. Treatment was great. I had therapy every single day, that felt good to get some of that crap out there. I did go a little crazy because they took away the drugs and the alcohol. and I didn't have anything to make myself feel different. So my cure for that, if you're ever in treatment, you want to make yourself feel different, get into a relationship. shave your head.
Nice. Yes.
Yeah.
And eat as much as you can. I came out of there, my jeans didn't fit. I was bald. And I was in the greatest relationship you'd ever seen. God put him in my life. We were both from Georgia. Everybody else was from New Jersey. So I did that, and they recommended I go to a halfway house after treatment, and I said, y'all are crazy. I know what those halfway houses are. They're nothing but crack houses, and I'm not going, and I'm going home. So I go home, and they told me in treatment, I heard them say, meeting makers make it. I said, okay, I can do that. So I went home, and I went to one meeting every day. I was in treatment 45 days. It took me another 30 days after treatment before I relapsed. I went to one meeting every day. That's all I did. Slowly, that misery, oh my God. The loneliness of not having those old friends, not having any new friends, because I was too scared to reach out to the people in Alcoholics Anonymous and saying, well, there's just not enough people my age. And they've already got their group of friends, and they don't want nothing to do with me. And I drank again. So I tried my deal. I tried, I said, I know I'm a drug addict, maybe I'm not an alcoholic, I'll just go out and drink and see how that works. And I came home and I cried to my dad. And about a week later, I said, well, maybe I'm an alcoholic and not a drug addict. And I tried that. And, you know, I tried everything. Like, I tried to get a sponsor. So I asked somebody to be my sponsor, but I didn't call them. But if you asked me if I had a sponsor, I could say, yes, her name is. You know, she told me, go home and read the first 164 pages of that book, Alcoholics Anonymous. My experience is I go through that book. When I sponsor somebody, I go through that book page by page with them. It's a textbook. It says that in the beginning. It's a textbook. It's recognized by the Library of Congress. And to me, I don't go and buy myself a history book and read the whole thing and think I know all the history there is to know. To me, it helps if somebody's there and they take me through it page by page and they teach it to me. You know, I'm not a good person when I'm drinking and using. I hate myself when I'm out there. So how am I going to treat anybody else good? I don't care about anybody else. I don't care about my family. I don't have any friends when I'm out there because they're embarrassed to be around me, and they'll tell me that to my face. You know, it's just lonely, and it's, you know, I do things that I would never do if I was in my right mind. I crossed lines that I thought I had drawn pretty firmly. And it just happens. And I say that I'm going to quit, and I just can't quit. I don't want to feel. I started using around 11 or 12, so I didn't feel anything from that time forward. If I started feeling feelings, I was going to find something to make myself feel different. So for a long time there, being sober was scary because as soon as I start feeling feelings, that's my reaction, is what can I take? I didn't know what feelings could do to me, honestly. I mean, I thought they might have the power to kill. You know, after I got sober, I was driving in my car one day. I was pretty new in sobriety, and I'm driving near 8111, and I'm kind of having a mental freak out, you know, and I'm feeling feelings. That's what it was. I was feeling feelings for one of the first times in my life. And all of a sudden, this voice comes in my head, and it says, feelings won't kill you. I mean, I was literally, looking around my car, who said that? And it was something that I had heard in treatment, I'm sure. But it hit me, and that's one of my God moments, you know. It was like one of my, you know, because that's one of my things that kept me from getting sober for so long, is every time I start feeling feelings, I can't do this. I have no defense. I have no defenses. I moved up to Atlanta. The cool thing about my stupid decisions is God can even use my selfishness and my crazy decisions to my own good. I was in that sick relationship that guy I met in treatment, and it was bad. And I went places I didn't think I would go. But I wanted so bad to be sober. And I had a calendar on the wall in our apartment down in West Palm Beach, Florida. This was on one of my many geographical cures, by the way. I had a calendar on the wall, and I would mark on there, okay, this is my sobriety date. 6 days later, I'd mark it again. So help me God, I'm not using anymore. I'm miserable. I don't want to feel this way. I got a sponsor. She's reading the book with me, and I'm marking my calendar again. I'm picking up another white chip. One time I went and picked up a white chip in a meeting in West Palm Beach, and this guy says, you know, Whitney, if you pick up any more of those white chips, you're going to be able to tile your bathroom with them. And I'm like, do you really need to say that to me? Do you think I don't notice that I have a whole pile of them sitting right, you know, I mean, anyway, I get really fired up about this program because it saved my life. You know, I was desperate, and what God gave me one of those. I call my higher power God. You call him what you want to. God gave me one of those moments of clarity while I was down in West Palm Beach, and finally it hit me. I can't stay sober in this relationship. I can't stay sober living in this apartment. I would relapse. He would relapse. We would relapse. They would relapse. So I had a moment of clarity, and I said, I got to get out of here. I didn't have any money. I said, I'm going back to Albany. That was the only place I knew where I could stay, you know, for free, live with my grandparents or my dad or whatever. So I'm driving. I'm on my way to Albany, and I've got everything I own packed in my Toyota Corolla. I mean, there's enough room for me to drive. And I get a phone call from the guy that I was living with, from his parents. They live in Atlanta. And his mom said, Whitney, look, I know that you want to get sober. And I know that Albany's not a good place for you. So I'm going to offer for you to come up to move up to Atlanta, and we'll pay for you to go into a halfway house. We'll pay for you to get some treatment. And it was like, this is my shot. This is it. This is all I got. And I said, okay, I'll do it. And I took it. And for me, you know, I did the first step out there. You know, I proved to myself that I'm an alcoholic and my life is unmanageable. To me, at that moment, I turned my will and my life over to the care of another human being. And I came up here and I moved into a halfway house. And I just remember my thought being at that time, if there is a God out there, he did not put me on this earth to be miserable like this. There is no way that somebody could make me, create me, and put me on this earth and expect me to live a miserable life. There's no way. It just doesn't make sense. So I moved up here. I moved into a halfway house, and I did what they told me to do. And I went 30 days, and I started getting real miserable again. And I said, I'm getting a sponsor. I'm going tonight, and I'm getting a sponsor. So I went up to 8111, and I walked up to the first woman I saw. I hear a lot in meetings or a lot of just people talking around the fellowship about take your time picking a sponsor. Get somebody that you want what they have, and y'all have stuff in common. And, I mean, I could sit around for months, years, picking somebody, the perfect person. For me, the experience was I was miserable. And I knew that you people, you know, I hated people in AA for a long time because y'all were staying sober and I couldn't do it. So I walked up to the first woman I saw at that meeting and I said, what's your name? My name's Whitney. Will you be my sponsor? She said, yes. I didn't ask her if she had at least a year of sobriety. Nowhere in this big book does it say that you have to have at least a year of sobriety to sponsor somebody. She took me through this book page by page, word by word, and she read it out loud to me so that I could take notes and highlight what I needed to. She took me through those steps. You know, life just changed, and it was like God gave me that grace to get sober. Everything didn't seem as overwhelming as it used to. I was able to do it day by day by just putting one foot in front of the other. I had a therapist. He said, Whitney, you don't have any point. You can't go back on your life because you started using so young and you've been unhappy for so long. You don't have a point of reference. You can't go back and say, well, I know it's possible because I was happy at this point. That wasn't the case. So he said, you're walking through total darkness and you don't see a light at the end of the tunnel. You just got to put one foot in front of the other and have faith. And that's what I did. I have it written on my book because I had to tell myself that. Just keep putting one foot in front of the other. One of the things that I learned in sobriety, I was listening to a speaker CD one time, and you know, I've held a lot of things against my mom. I had a resentment against her for a long time because she abandoned me, and she wasn't there for me, and is how I saw it anyway. And one time, me and Hunter are on a trip somewhere, and we're listening to speaker CDs. And this woman was speaking, and she said, you know, all my life I had this thing against my mom. She didn't love me the way I thought that she should love me. And she didn't treat me the way I thought she should treat me. And I sat down with my mom one time, and my mom said to me, "Why do you hate me?" And I said to my mom, "Because you didn't love me the way I thought you should love me." And her mom said to her, "I put a roof over your head. And I clothed you, and I fed you. What else do you want? I loved you." And at that moment, she realized that when her mother was a child, her parents couldn't put a roof over her head and feed her and clothe her. And so to her, that's what she could do to love her daughter. And at that moment, she realized that her mom was doing the best that she knew how to do. And that hit me so hard. Because my parents did the best they knew how to do. And they love me with everything they have. And today I can live my life and I can think, what can I do for them? How can I be there for my parents? Why is it always about me? Why do I have to go into this situation thinking of what I can get from it? And that just hit me. And I know Hunter was in the car with me, and he didn't even know I was having that moment that I was having. But that's just one of the lessons, you know, one of the many God moments that I've had in this program. You know, I have a job today. When I first got sober, when I was in treatment, I started looking back because I said, well, I didn't get fired that much. But I realized that I always left right before it could happen. I just didn't show back up. And I started counting, and it was kind of scary. When I first got sober, I was unemployable. I couldn't work. I had to focus on nothing but this right here. You know, my first job was waitressing, and I was serving alcohol. And one of my lessons I learned was not every opportunity that God puts in front of me is an opportunity that I have to take. I have a job now that I've been at for about a year and a half. And at first, I thought that I should get a medal for showing up on time every day. And then I realized that that's what normal people do. They only knew what I used to be like. You know, and I have a boss who told me yesterday, "Whitney, I'll give you a great reference if you need one." That's amazing. You know, I have a relationship with a man. God put him in my life because I don't know what I deserve. I would have settled for much less. I would, because I don't think that I deserve that much. I don't think that I'm that great of a person. I don't think that I deserve that much love and that much respect. But God put this man in my life, and he treats me so good. And he shows me what true patience is, and true compromise, and true understanding. He has held my hand. I started, you know, doing some therapy on my childhood trauma. And there were times when I didn't think I could go on. And he let me cry. And he just sat there. And he just lets me cry. And we're going to get married. And when he started talking about getting married, I got kind of scared. Because my parents, that didn't work out too well. And, you know, so I'm kind of scared of all that. That's a big commitment. I mean, because when I get married, I want that to last for a long time. I'm not just jumping in there, you know. I mean, I got to think about this. So I talked to my grandparents, because they've been married for 50 years. And I'm on the phone with both of them. You know, they still got a house phone. And so Mimi's on one line and Peepaw's on the other line. And I said, he's talking about getting married and I don't know what to do. I'm kind of freaking out here. And my Peepaw says, well, hon, it's all about compromise. Ain't that right, Ma? And my Mimi said, yep. this program is just amazing. I was so stressed out this week because we're moving tomorrow. I had a job interview this morning, and then I had to work all day today, and then I'm telling my story right now, and then we're moving tomorrow, and then I have another job interview on Monday, and I was kind of freaked out, and I was thinking about it at work today, and, you know, I'm an alcoholic. My mind goes to drinking. And the thought hit me, Whitney, you wouldn't have anything that is going on in your life today if it was not for Alcoholics Anonymous. Drinking is not the solution. It's not like I was, you know, fantasizing about drinking or whatever, but the thought comes to my mind. I'm an alcoholic. That's where I go. And it just hit me. You wouldn't have a job interview if you weren't sober. You wouldn't have a job. You wouldn't have a relationship. You would not be moving. You might be moving, but. And one thing that I say when I tell my story is, today, Alcoholics Anonymous is the foundation of my life. I went through a lot of therapy. Starting at the age of 9, I started going to therapy, and I had many therapists, and I went to a lot of treatment centers, and I had therapy there, And I was not like it says in the big book how we might not have been completely honest with our therapist. I laid it out there. But I couldn't get better. And what I've learned through this program is I have to get sober. Nothing I do is going to work until I get sober and I get that. That's my foundation. I can't do better. I can't get anywhere unless I have that as my foundation. And I have no excuse to not sponsor women. When I started going through my therapy for the trauma stuff, I thought, well, maybe I shouldn't sponsor women, or maybe I shouldn't go to meetings for a while, because, I mean, it was really hard for me to be in a room full of people like this. I would freak out. I tried the experiment of not going to a meeting for a week, and I probably got a little insane. And I realized that I need this. And I need to help other people. I see so many people in Alcoholics Anonymous who come in here and they take and take and take what this program has to give and they don't give it back. How selfish would that be of me to come in here and work those 12 steps and get sober and not give it back to somebody who needs it just as bad as I needed it? That's just not the way it works. And also, I'm an alcoholic. I mean, I'm sick. I'm real sick. And if I don't do this every day, I get sick again. You know, I go right back to my old ways, and then I'm really miserable because I'm not drinking, but I'm not, you know, putting spiritual principles into effect in my life. You know, and today it's about being here, being present. In my job, it's about being present. I come in contact, I don't know why, but God loves to put messed up people in my life. Like at my work, people just come in high all the time or drunk, and I don't get it. But I'm able to just be there today. I wanted to read something that's in Daily Reflections. I knew I was probably going to forget the page number. I hope not. It says on page 245, it says, I believe a power greater than myself chose me to recover, yet I do not know why. I try not to worry or wonder about what I do not yet know. Instead, I trust that if I continue to work the steps, practice the AA principles in my life, and share my story, I will be guided lovingly toward a deep and mature spirituality in which more will be revealed to me. For the time being, it is a gift for me to trust God, work the steps, and help others. I get this notion in my mind that I should be somewhere that I'm not. Like, I should be there, wherever there is. When I'm struggling and I realize that I'm human and that I still have character defects and that maybe I'm not making as much progress. See, I think I should be there, not going through what I'm going through right here, right in this moment. I think I should be past that by now. And I realize that there is no finish line. This is a journey. And I have to keep myself in this moment. And I have to enjoy where I'm at today. So thank you so much for letting me tell my story.